So as I've been saying probably for the last few weeks, it's, you know, the whole idea of war has been on my mind quite a bit. And it's been also been on my mind and what to do about that in the context of these talks when we gather together and meditate and talk about the Dharma. Sometimes I think, well, maybe we shouldn't talk about it at all, but just focus on the timeless Dharma. And other times that seems ridiculous. But to talk about it too directly, it also sometimes doesn't seem quite right either. I haven't really quite known what to do. And each time I've come to talk, I've kind of somehow tried to do something that seemed appropriate at that particular time. But the fact that I'm a little bit confused about how to talk about the Dharma or talk about practice or talk about practice in the context of world events at this particular time might mean that there's a lot of people who are confused these days. I certainly am confused when I read the papers and learn what's going on out there. And part of me is confused. Part of me feels certainly afraid of some of the many scenarios. I sometimes feel that we've ended up in a lose-lose-lose situation. No matter what happens, it's going to be a problem. So this is what occurred to me today. There's a story of a pumpkin patch behind a temple. And one day, the pumpkins started fighting with each other. And it was a huge brawl, noisy, messy. And so the nun who lived in that temple, the abbess, came out and saw what was going on in the fields and said, you know, try to say, stop fighting. And they wouldn't listen. So she had to kind of really use a strong voice and said, stop and meditate. So they stopped, but they didn't know how to meditate. So she taught them and gave them instructions. And sure enough, they started meditating and they got calmed down and they got quiet. And once they got calm and quiet, for some reason or other, they was going to scratch their heads or something. And they discovered they had a strange thing on top of their head. What's this thing here? And so they kind of felt it. It kind of left them. It kind of was this little thing. It left. And they followed it. The pumpkin followed. So it went, it was attached to the neighboring pumpkin. And they followed, kind of glanced along, and that was attached to the next pumpkin. And the next pumpkin. And in fact, the whole pumpkin patch was grew from a single seed. Then all the pumpkins were connected to each other. They were all the same plant. And from that day on, they stopped fighting. So the idea of... So one of the reasons I like this story is that these are people who stop, pumpkins, who stop to meditate, to stop to get calm enough to see clearly what's going on. And I think if a Dharma has anything to offer, it offers us certainly the tools, the resources for helping us become calm, helping us be the custodians of our own hearts so it doesn't get bitter or filled with hate or anger or fear. But also more important than the tools and the resources, it hopefully inspires or mirrors for us, gives us the example of a life that can be dedicated. Really, dedicated is a strong word, devoted, committed to finding out how to be calm or peaceful or loving in the midst of whatever is happening in life, no matter how difficult it might be. And so then they got calm. And once the pumpkins got calm, then they were able to find out how intimately they were connected to everyone around them. One of the aspects of one of the manifestations of a calm, settled, awake state is the feeling of love, is a feeling of connectedness, a feeling of empathy, the feeling of being sensitive to ourselves, but from the context here, more important to the world around us. That meditation is not simply some way of, you know, healing our own wounds, just leaving it at that, or simply coping better for ourselves. But even if you don't want it to be, meditation will, if it's done well and you settle well, connect you or open you, make you sensitive to the sense of connectedness that we all have to each other, everyone. And from that, or that is, or from that is a sense of love. And I said last week at a teaching here that someone said, commented, that Buddhism doesn't talk much about love. And my response was, that's all it is. It's about all about love. And so that's a whole discussion, what we mean about love. It takes many forms. But I thought this was a very good night to read a poem that has kind of become almost, it's repeated so often that it's become like the liturgy in Western Buddhism. And I'm sure many of you have heard it, but in that it's a liturgy. Liturgy functions in a different place in the psyche than maybe just having heard something already know it. If you listen to this, maybe listen to this at the same time, reach up and feel that stalk, you know, leaving your head or your heart. This is by Thich Nhat Hanh, and it's called, Please Call Me by My True Names. Do not say that I'll depart tomorrow, because even today I still arrive. Look deeply. I arrive in every second, to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird whose wings are still fragile, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, in order to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that are alive. I am the mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of the river. I am the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I am the frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond, and I am also the grass snake who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks, and I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I am a member of the Politburo, with plenty of power in my hands. And I am the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people, dying slowly in a forced labor camp. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom. My pain is like a river of tears, so full it fills up the four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up, and so the door of my heart can be left open, the door of compassion. Thich Nhat Hanh gave a beautiful teaching once. He was talking about the pirates who lived in the fishing villages in kind of southeastern Thailand, who back in the 80s, would go off, set off by ship, and sometimes harass, and worse, the Vietnamese boat people. And he said, you know, if I grew up in the same situation as they did, if I grew up in those poor Thai villages, desperate, and that environment, those conditions coming together in me, I think I would end up in the same place. I would have been a pirate in the same way. So what Thich Nhat Hanh was doing is he's not seeing people as different from himself. He's seeing himself in other people. And it's all too easy to set up a dichotomy or a duality or separation between us and them, self and others. And sometimes it takes ridiculous forms. It's that country versus this country. And then but then it's not just everybody in this country is on my team, it's just the people in my political party and them. And then it's not just the people in my political party, it's those people in my political party also belong to my church. But it's not everybody in my sangha, it's those people who do X. It's not just those people who do X, but it's those people who do X who are my friends versus everybody else. But it's not, I'm not really sure of all my friends. It's really me and them. And I'm not really sure about myself. it's all too easy to set up this world of dichotomizing or of separation, them versus, me or us. And Thich Nhat Hanh takes a very radically different approach, where he sees self in the other. He sees himself in the other, sees the possibility he could be like that person. So rather than seeing him as better than or purer than, or there's a kind of real feeling of kind of an empathy or kind of a sense of understanding of the other person. I read something by Martin Luther King where he said, he claims, I don't know so much Greek, but he claims the word agape. Now, agape, which is kind of a love, is originally had the meaning in Greek of meaning understanding, to understand. So is there a kind of love that comes from understanding each other? And understanding it comes from understanding how similar we are with each other rather than them, versus us, or us versus them. And now he doesn't, he's not denying the fact that some people are pirates here. He's not forgiving them for being pirates. He's not encouraging them to be pirates because he identifies with them. But he's not willing to banish them from his heart. He's not willing to treat them as the other and then alienate them or alienate himself from them or demonize them or some way. And it's not an easy thing to do. The Thich Nhat Hanh, who many people highly revere for this great Buddhist practitioner, I think maybe it's in the front of his book, The Miracle of Mindfulness. I'm not sure where the story is, but he, during the Vietnam War, he was going around this country giving talks. I guess he came to a high school or auditorium or a college auditorium. He was giving a public talk about the Vietnam War. And the person who was moderating his event tells a story. So the person being with him up there on the stage, the MC. And he said, after Thich Nhat Hanh talked, a man stood up in the audience who was furious at Thich Nhat Hanh and said that he had no right to be telling anybody in America about Vietnam and that he should just go back there and mind his own business or something. And something to that effect. But even much stronger, very critical of Thich Nhat Hanh and critical of anybody who was opposing the Vietnam War and America was justified in doing that. And Thich Nhat Hanh paused a little bit and then said something. And I apologize, I don't remember, but he said something wise and something that connected with the person, I hope, and something that, he just took it in stride and responded some way. And then he excused himself from the room. And he left for a little while. He went out to the parking lot or outside. And so the MC, who was responsible for kind of facilitating it, followed him out because it was still the middle of the event. And he found Thich Nhat Hanh outside the building, breathing really deeply. And he said, "What's going on? Are you okay?" And Thich Nhat Hanh said, "I'm okay, but I got really angry at that man." And it took all my effort to remain calm. Because by being calm, that's where the manifestation of the teaching is, where the, you know, where I have a chance of connecting with this person. And now I'm processing my anger. And once I'm finished, I'll come back in again. So, you know, the reason I tell that story is that Thich Nhat Hanh was struggling. And you might have a different opinion about maybe how he should have handled a situation like that. But he had this complete commitment in a very difficult situation to try to work with that at tremendous cost to himself. You know, he had to, you know, it wasn't that it was easy, that it was, you know, it wasn't that it was, you know, he didn't have strong reactions. So, you know, when he says, you know, he identifies with the other person, it doesn't mean that he remains calm. But because of that, his Dharma practice, and because of his sense of connectedness, I suspect that he's motivated, he's committed to maintaining his Dharma practice. And if there's anything I want to underscore tonight, it's this point, that it's so important not to sacrifice your practice because you're upset. So all of Buddhism is about love. In this thing that I read of Martin Luther King, he then distinguishes the three different types of love that appear in the Greek Old Testament. And there's eros, and there's philia, and there's agape. And he says that eros, again, I don't know the history of this word, but he claims that eros originally didn't mean romantic love, or as it means nowadays, but rather it meant kind of love or yearning for the divine. And so that's quite something, to switch gears, switch directions, that way the meaning of it. Many words change meaning over the centuries. And philia means the kind of a love of friends, kind of a love that between people, kind of exchange, affection between people, that involves kind of a mutual exchange of good feelings, goodwill. And then he calls agape a kind of love that is not an exchange, that doesn't require getting anything back in return. And he says it doesn't require affection, because it's a kind of love you would have for your enemy. And you're not expected to have affection for your enemy. But Martin Luther King does say that it's possible to have love, a kind of a love that recognizes the common humanity we all have, recognizes their humanity. And that it's that agape love that that Martin Luther King held up as being so important for the nonviolent work that he represented and championed in the civil rights times that revolutionized this country. So what's interesting a little bit is that in this Greek language, in the Greek Christian tradition, they have three different words for love. And in English, it could be said, we really only have one word. We have the word love, which sometimes greatly inspire us to great heights, and sometimes we're so sick of the word. You know, it's so used everywhere and all the time. I mean, to hear, you know, I love Chinese food. I mean, Chinese food is really great. I love it. But, or, you know, or I love American food, or I love, you know, popsicles. You know, there's all these things we love. And then we say, you know, I love my friend, or I love my neighbor. And is it the same? We mean the same thing? We love our neighbor the same way we love our popsicles? What does it mean? So maybe it's not so useful to use the word love, because so many different meanings are subsumed under that word. And so my proposal to you is that this is what's happened to Buddhism. That Buddhism doesn't use the word love explicitly because it's not such a useful word to use. But rather, Buddhism uses other words that mean the same thing, that are perhaps more exact, more precise in the nuances, the different shades of love, what's implied. Like love is like this umbrella word, and then you have to specify what kind of love you're talking about. Eros, agape, philia. So in Buddhism, there's a whole series of words. There's a word called pema, which is best translated as the English word affection. And the understanding is that Pema generally is a problem because it has within it attachment or clinging. The person you're clinging to, the person you have affection for. And therefore, affection, when it has clinging as part of it, when it's Pema, is considered a hindrance to the spiritual life. And one of the great paradoxes here is that to feel, to be a pumpkin and really feel your connectedness to everyone, that you actually feel how connected you are. You feel other people, you're more tuned into other people, the less affection, the less attachment you have towards other people. Attachment in terms of clinging to other people. And because many of us associate love with clinging, it's almost inconceivable to see them as separate. To hear, don't cling or don't be attached to others, seems to be dehumanizing. So Pema is that form of love which has clinging as part of it. That's one word. Another word is, which is a general umbrella word, is the word Brahma-vihara, which means the abode of the gods, or the divine abode, the abode of Brahma, the great god. And these are the to dwell in love is to be like a god, is the implication in this word. And there are four different kinds of divine love within Buddhism. These are four kinds of love which are not characterized by clinging. So the fact that you're able to release your clinging doesn't mean that you're going to abandon your capacity to feel love. There's actually four different types, actually more, but in this particular list there's four. And the first one is loving kindness. His word is metta. Metta is also closely connected to the word to soften or tenderize. Soft, tenderized heart. That tenderness or sensitivity that then opens up to a kind of love or caring kindness to anybody and everybody. One of the remarkable discoveries for me in doing Vipassana practice meditation was the discovery that as the meditation deepened, and as my sense of barriers, my attachments, my clinging, my fears, my sense of separation from people, the sense of being defensive, all the kind of those kind of things started being shed, at least temporarily, in the meditation, falling away, that in that space that was left, in that tenderness or openness or emptiness that's left, was born or arose love, this a kindness, this loving kindness. And I was just blown away that there was this capacity for loving kindness within me that didn't require me to have an object for the love. It wasn't like I had to first find someone who seemed worthy of love and then, yes, I love Don because he's worthy. You know, it was there. And then I would see Don. Don's worthy, but anyway, then it's, it would be, once the radar is set, it's a little bit of a problem because when I was in the monasteries, sometimes it was a little bit too easy to fall in love with people because you have this wonderful tenderness and kindness and open-hearted feeling. And because some people, I know from first-hand experience, some people like myself can, in the transition period of learning the territory of love, can confuse this kind of open-hearted, loving connectedness that comes out of kind of an open heart of meditation with romantic love. And, because we don't have much experience with the non-romantic, intense, metta can be extremely intense, feeling of delight and love and appreciation of someone. And if you don't have a lot of experience with that, then, maybe the first associations you might have with that is romantic love. And then you get in trouble. But it was quite an amazing thing to discover this capacity that arose kind of without a reason. You don't have to be having a good day, like wonderful things happening to you. Sometimes actually be quite hard, but somehow with this tenderness, it's as if innate in the heart is this capacity for goodwill, for kindness, for connectedness, for kind of this loving kindness. universal goodwill. And this kind of loving kindness, actually all four of these Brahmaviharas, are a kind of love like agape, which requires nothing in return. And the cultivation of loving kindness as a practice very specifically includes the very difficult task, no one's going to say that it's easy, but the very difficult task of learning how to have this kind of love for your enemies. And again, I just love it that the spiritual tradition that has practices and teachings and puts importance on actually taking the time and the effort to see what it takes to love your enemy. And no one's saying it's easy. But the fact there are people who take that difficult task on, they find it worthwhile. They find at least somewhere in their head, in their hearts, they say, yeah, it's worthwhile at least trying to do this. Can I do it? As opposed to staying closed or staying resentful or angry. So there's loving kindness. Then loving kindness will morph itself into different shapes depending on what it encounters. It's kind of like loving kindness is empathy, or closely connected to empathy. And that empathy encounters someone who's suffering, then it takes the form of compassion. And compassion is, empathy is kind of, you know, sharing in the joy or the suffering of someone else. So compassion is that empathy that shares in the suffering of someone else. Not the kind of awareness of someone else's suffering that makes you better than or puts pity on them, looks down at them, or feels sorry for them. But almost as if it's happening to you, as equals. You recognize your own, maybe you know so well your own suffering, they say, oh, you recognize yourself and the other person almost. So you really kind of compassionately, really, you know, you empathize. If someone's having joy, wonderful things happening to them in life, then that empathy takes the form of appreciative joy, sympathetic joy. So again, an empathic response to the joy and appreciation of someone else. And the final form of love, which sounds very odd to hear, is equanimity. So how is equanimity a form of love? And equanimity as a Brahmavihara, equanimity as a meditative experience, a spiritual experience in Buddhism, is far from a neutral experience. It's a very almost intense state to be in, intense mental state or state of heart. And it's, in some sense, it's one of the greatest, most pleasant states you can have, even though we say it's equanimity. So how is it a form of love? There are states of equanimity that are not forms of love, but the analogy might help. It's given, and the analogy is a mother who has four children, and the first is a newborn baby who's healthy and doing well. And the mother just has all this maternal kindness, maternal caring instinct, this goodwill, this loving kindness for the child. Wishes the child well, is happy with the child being there, and all this. The mother has an older child who maybe is, you know, adolescent, but who's has some terrible illness. Maybe is in some ways handicapped physically and is struggling with the illness, and no one knows how well the child's going to do and grow up because of this illness. And so the mother's love takes the form of compassion, feeling the child's suffering. And compassion is more than empathy. It's also wishing that child to be free of that suffering. And so the mother will do anything to try to help the child along and help heal the child. And so love takes the form when this child is suffering. This maternal love takes the form of really wanting that child to be healed, to be well, to be free of that distress and suffering. The mother has an older child still who is just, maybe early 20s and just become married and just started a new job and just all of life is just ahead of that person and feels, you know, really, so the mother feels all this joy that this child has gotten that far and sees all this joy and this possibility and the world opening up for her child. And she just feels all this great happiness and delight in this child now is a success. And then the mother has still an older child who maybe is, you know, I don't know, getting on and well-established, middle age and well-established in life and has a family and has work and everything's well taken care of and been that way for a while and stable and secure. And so there, the mother knows that child is well taken care of, everything's going well, no, there's no great crisis, no problems. She's not really excited about what's happening because they reach kind of a wonderful steady state of being peaceful and stable and secure and all that. So the love in relationship to that last child, the oldest one, takes the form of equanimity. She feels equanimous love. She's very settled and at peace and happy with how that child is in his or her life. And then there's so those are four kinds of love: loving kindness, appreciative joy, compassion, and equanimity. And then there's a fourth word. It's kind of like the Eskimos have 40 words for snow. So the Buddhists have all these different words for love. And another word is, which is not known so much in Western Buddhism, is anukampa. And if you read the suttas, actually, if you read in English, you won't tell. But the word anukampa appears a lot. And it means compassion. The word most of us know as compassion is karuna. But karuna is one of the Brahma Viharas. Anukampa is not a Brahma Vihara. Anukampa, perhaps, is more like empathy. Whereas karuna is not only empathy, but in addition to empathy, wishing that person to be alleviated of their suffering. Anukampa is simply the capacity of empathy in the context of other people's suffering. And so sometimes, you know, maybe we can't do anything about it. Maybe we feel a lot of equanimity about the situation. But there's this, all this, this anukampa that's there. So I have no idea how well I conveyed it, this idea. But I'm giving you the idea there's different forms of love. And another form of love, the last one I'll mention tonight, which maybe a lot of people wouldn't recognize as love, and maybe it's an idiosyncratic idea that I have of myself to call this love, but is the state of not clinging. If we're able to have the heart not clinging to anything whatsoever, that what remains or what that is a form of love. And the central task of Buddhism is to learn how not to cling so that we can be free of suffering, and maybe that's enough. But one of the byproducts of that is that there's this tenderness of the heart, this softness of the heart, this clear seeing that happens, where we feel the interconnectedness, we feel connected to others, we feel sensitive to others, we feel tenderness in the context of meeting other people. There's love there in the state of non-clinging. I find it remarkable, as I've said already, I apologize for repeating myself, I find it remarkable that something as simple as meditation practice, quieting the mind, seeing, investigating, seeing clearly what goes on inside our hearts and minds, that that process in and of itself leads to us, to our awakening of love, of caring. And a lot of people these days are wondering, what is it the Dharma has to offer me or society in the context of a whole nation going to war, where many people will probably get killed and injured? The suffering will ripple out, you know, because the people killed and injured and who suffer, you know, they have mothers and children and fathers and, you know, ripple out to their relatives and friends and the communities all around the world. You know, what does the Dharma have to offer? And there's something sometimes we overlook, or we don't think about. So maybe because of that, I'd like to mention it. Is that Dharma practice, meditation practice, is one of the great resources human beings have. There are other great resources besides what Buddhism has to offer, but one of the great resources the humans have for helping people heal the scars of war. And when I was in Burma, my teacher there periodically would tell us stories of people who had been involved in war in Burma in very all kinds of ways, as soldiers, as victims of war. And he would tell us stories about what it was like when they came to the monastery to meditate. And he loved the stories of the soldiers who were sometimes were atrocious people, did terrible things, tortured people and stuff, killed people. And he liked to tell us stories because these are all these kind of the success stories, because he would talk about how incredibly difficult it was for them to meditate, because they had to face their karma of what they did. And if you go really deep into your psyche, you have to face your karma. You have to face what you've done. And you can imagine, you know, to have to face yourself as a torturer, as a murderer. And he talked about how incredibly painful and difficult it was for him to do that. And then at some point, you know, it seems like they were going to explode. And sometimes they exploded, or something dramatic happened. They broke. And then there was some kind of healing. And, he, you know, he was telling the stories to inspire us with the possibility. If they can do it, you can do it. And then there's lots of stories also of people, for example, Vietnam vets, people who experienced war directly here in this country, who have ended up on meditation retreats and their experience of the healing that came from that kind of work. Or I've had people come to retreats that I've talked to who were victims of war, who were in concentration camps in World War II, who were in Central America and watched in the early 80s, I guess, or 70s, watched horrific things being done, murders being done by some of the soldiers in some of those small countries down there against some of the villagers, and couldn't do anything because a gun was pointed to them and watching people being killed. And then coming and finding meditation practice as a place to heal the scars of war. And to me, it gives me, you know, kind of a great hope. It's one of the kind of, as tragic as war is, the fact that the world has resources for after war, for the scars of war, to me is really important. And perhaps we can't do, you know, some people feel hopeless, helpless in this kind of situation here. You know, people, maybe some people have gone off and protested and written letters and done what they can do, but, you know, you know, the course is set and it seems like there's, you know, no one's listening who can make a difference. And so maybe what we do is we prepare ourselves for what comes after. And maybe if our doors are open and we know how to be sensitive to all the different kinds of pumpkins that there are, that we'll know how to create a welcoming environment here, so that someday someone who was bombed on in Iraq, or someone who was the bomber in the plane who pushed the button for the cruise missile, if they walk in here, they'll feel welcome here, and that they'll find here and other Dharma centers the resources to heal the scars from their experience of war. So I hope that gives you a little bit of hope. You don't feel completely helpless if you were feeling helpless. If you remember the possibility of healing and peace that's inherent in the Dharma. And I hope that this talk, which has been spontaneous and probably inadequate as a talk, I hope that if nothing else, that it encourages you to consider hanging in there with your spiritual practice, feeling its incredible value, and not giving up on it, no matter how difficult it is for you and how difficult your reactions are, that your commitment is to come back to yourself and try to have the clarity and the commitment to find love, to find calm, to find peace, and to find some way to see in the other yourself. And so the words of loving kindness kind of end with, may all beings be happy. May all my friends, my family, myself, my neighbors, people I don't know, may all my enemies, may all of them not be banished from my heart. May all of them, may I some way extend my kindness, my care, my goodwill to all beings everywhere. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. So, thank you very much. And I hope I don't have to see you on Thursday. If I do, then I hope, if we do need to, I hope to see you.